Capitol building was evacuated this afternoon due to a suspicious letter. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sari Jovetic, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce is our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Reporter Ruth Eddy prepares us for the Southgate Mall fireworks in Missoula. And in tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the U.S. Forest Service Assistant Director about fire operations and firefighter safety. Law enforcement and fire officials evacuated the state capitol building today after a suspicious letter was received, intended for Governor Steve Bullock. Officials say the governor was not in the building at the time. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the state employee receiving the letter has been quarantined, though there have been no injuries.
Helena Fire Captain Brian Roberts says his department and the Helena Police Department were called to the Capitol building at about 12:15. A mail handler for Governor Steve Bullock's office had opened an anonymous letter inside.
Piece of material that is a piece of cloth that's wrapped in some tape. And she just felt it was real suspicious at this time, so we said we'd come take a sample of it.
Officers evacuated the entire building and quarantined the mail handler. She is not showing signs of injury. Roberts says those examining the material say an explosive has been ruled out.
We have no idea who sent the letter to the governor's office at this time.
As of our deadline, two teams from the fire department were continuing to take samples. The investigation into who sent the letter is ongoing, too. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, an appeals court panel overseeing the misconduct investigation into former U.S. District Judge Richard Siebel says it has issued a new order in the Montana jurist case. But the Judicial Council of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals will wait 63 days after its June 28th filing to release the order, allowing time for a petition for review to be submitted. The 9th Circuit announced the council's order on its website yesterday in a brief statement by Chief Judge Alex Kaczynski. Siebel retired May 3rd after the Judicial Council completed its investigation into a racist email forwarded by Siebel last year and involving President Barack Obama. The council said then Siebel's retirement made its previous March 15th order on the investigation moot. Siebel has not said why he retired.
A politically active nonprofit group tried to appointees of former Governor Brian Schweitzer shared the governor's campaign address and received contributions from organizations with which Schweitzer was involved. The ties date back to the 2012 election cycle when the governor was bashing other such nonprofits for hiding the state disclosure laws. The group called the Council for a Sustainable America shut down in early 2010 and transferred its money to a Washington-based organization that later moved to the same Helena Post office box. A Schweitzer political operative says neither organization was ever involved in Montana politics. The Council for a Sustainable America received a $335,000 contribution from the Democratic Governors Association in 2009, according to the disclosure forms. Schweitzer says the DGA chairman at the time.
Montana state prison officials have ended their ground search for a convicted sex offender who escaped Monday morning. Warden Leroy Kierkegaard says crews have been searching through thick brush near the prison for signs of 42-year-old Dean Randolph Jess. That portion of the search ended yesterday. The vehicle Jess used to escape was found Monday at 11:30 a.m., about 1.5 miles south of the prison property. Prison staffers are investigating Jess's recent activities and have searched his cell, but Kierkegaard says they found no clues about where he might go. He was described as not a problem inmate and had worked with the prison motor vehicle maintenance program since 2006. Jess was serving a 55-year prison sentence for a Park County conviction.
Mark Meyer put in two infantry tours in the Middle East, but nothing that he saw overseas frightened him as much as the Bitterroot River on Monday afternoon. Meyer and his two sons started their float at Rotary Park just north of Hamilton late that morning. Their watercraft included a small pontoon boat and a couple of inner tubes. They had never floated this section of the river before and had no idea that there was a dangerous diversion dam just a few miles below Woodside Crossing. And they saw warning signs posted on the banks, but by the time they understood the danger, it was too late. Their pontoon boat immediately flipped over backward in the water below the dam. All three were thrown into the river and were immediately caught in the powerful hydraulics that flipped them under the water. The raft floated about 100 yards downstream where Meyer and his sons were stuck in the backwater for close to an hour as emergency crews mobilized to help. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Fisheries Manager Pat Saffel said the department has new, larger slines it plans to put to post as soon as possible to warn people about the hazard at the diversion dam. Additional signs at fishing access sites upstream have also been posted.
Helena Valley Irrigation District workers found the body of a 65-year-old woman who went missing during an evening walk. Lewis and Clark County Sheriff Leo Dutton says the woman went for a walk at about 10 p.m. Monday in the East Helena Valley. Her husband reported her missing just before 6:30 a.m. yesterday. While officers checked for usage on her credit cards, Under Sheriff Dave Rao contacted the irrigation district and asked them to check the canals because the woman often walked along them. Her body was found at 3 p.m. yesterday in the Helena Valley. Dutton estimated her body traveled about 10 miles in the swift-moving water. Coroner Mickey Nelson says an autopsy is planned, but Dutton says no foul play is suspected. The woman's name has not been released.
Cascade County officials say a 22-year-old man who was rescued from the Missouri River near Ulm has died. The sheriff's office told the Great Falls Tribune the man died late yesterday at a Great Falls hospital. His name was not immediately released. Officials say the man had gone into the river Monday evening to help two girls, ages 14 and 18, who were in distress and then got into trouble himself. A 21-year-old Old Malmstrom Airman Jake Bush rescued the girls and then went back for the 22-year-old man, who by then had gone underwater. Bush used CPR skills he had learned during training just hours earlier until emergency responders arrived.
A 17-year-old boy is missing on the Missouri River south of Great Falls. Cascade County Search and Rescue and the Sheriff's Office continued searching this morning for the boy who disappeared underwater at about 5:45 p.m. yesterday. The Great Falls Tribune reports witnesses said the boy was in the water at the Big Bend Fishing Access Point when they lost sight of him. Authorities began dragging the river about 6:30 p.m. with a search and rescue boat while Mercy Flight performed an aerial search. The boy's name has not been released.
One of two people injured in the crash of a single-engine airplane near Fort Smith remained hospitalized today. St. Vincent Health Care spokeswoman Lynn Ratcliffe said the condition of the patient admitted after yesterday's crash had been upgraded to fair. A second person brought to the hospital was treated in the emergency room and released. Their names haven't been released. The plane crashed at about 10:30 a.m. on the Crow Indian Reservation. Authorities confirmed two people were on board. A spokesman with the Federal Aviation Administration said no new information was available from that agency. In Wyoming, Campbell County Sheriff Bill Pownell told the Gillette News Record that flight originated in Gillette, but he did not know who was operating the plane. The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating the crash.
As people light up their barbecues for fireworks, the Missoula Police Department will add four more traffic patrols for the 4th of July. Since alcohol-related driving crashes make this holiday one of the deadliest, Sergeant Greg Amundson says there will be zero tolerance for impaired drivers.
But what we do see here in the city of Missoula is a significant increase the weekend of the 4th of July, especially when it falls on like a Thursday, Friday, or a Monday, where you kind of make a long weekend out of it.
He also advises those who are planning on drinking to keep ride options on speed dial or to use a ride home program.
Probably the best thing, I think, to do is if you're going to go downtown to celebrate or go to a party at someone's house is just get dropped off. Then you don't even have your car there, or take a cab or take the bus there.
The Montana Department of Transportation Selective Traffic Enforcement Program's grants fund the additional patrols.
It seems like no Independence Day celebration is complete without some fireworks, but within the city of Missoula, fireworks are illegal. That is, with one big exception.
Tucked in the administration office of the Southgate Mall, marketing director Trisha Petalou isn't wearing her normal clothes.
A 4th of July t-shirt and casual jeans, of course, because we're doing quite a bit of running around today.
Petalou is also appropriately wearing sparkly silver shoes. She's in charge of the largest firework display in Montana, and it happens tomorrow in the Southgate Mall parking lot. The Southgate Mall firework display is almost as old as the Southgate Mall.
Pretty close. It was just a few years after the mall opened that they started doing the fireworks out here. There's kind of that misconception that it's the city that does that, that puts this together, but it's just the efforts of the mall and want to offer something back to the community.
Petalou stresses that it is a community event, free and open to everyone.
We do ask that people leave their alcohol and their fireworks at home.
But besides that,
they'll bring their families and have a little barbecue or sit in the tailgates of their vehicles. Just about anything goes. Well, we actually had people trying to come out and set up their RVs and stuff for the show yesterday.
She says there's a reason why.
They have a fabulous ground show that you don't get to see unless you're right here.
The aerial show can be seen from around town, and in her 19 years, she's only seen the show canceled once.
The show will go. It will go. So the only time that we don't do the fireworks is if there's extreme winds or extreme rain. But outside of that, we always do it.
Montana Display Fireworks is actually the one hooking up the wires and preparing the explosives. The local company is comprised mostly of area businessmen.
You know, I mean, it is electrical, so some of them are electricians, but most of them are just people that have normal jobs like you and me, and they take the day off from their normal jobs to come and do this for us.
Petaloo herself will be at the main stage, along with everyone who worked to set up the event.
I wouldn't miss it for the world.
The event starts at 9 with the Missoula City Band, and fireworks go off at 10:30. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
Hundreds of firefighters making progress on the wildfire outside the mountain town of Yarnell, Arizona, were coming off the line to share a moment of silence and watch a procession of the towed vehicles of the 19 elite hotshot crew members killed over the weekend. Firefighters in Arizona and across the country paused throughout the day to remember the Granite Mountain hotshots and recognize the dangers firefighters face every day. In tonight's feature interview, Edward O'Brien talked with the U.S. Forest Service Assistant Director of Fire Operations, Steve Gage. Gage and his team essentially determine which fires pose the biggest risk to life and property and distribute resources accordingly. Gage says firefighting safety has come a long way over the years.
Oh, since Man Gulch, boy, we've made, you know, some extraordinary improvements in not only how we outfit our firefighters, you know, with the Nomex, the fire-resistant clothing. Again, they're not fireproof, but fire-resistant clothing. The evolution of the generations of the fire shelters, our engines, our air assets, all of the equipment and the things that we've used. Technology has really pushed us ahead in the safety arena with the advent of, you know, weather satellites and the Doppler radar and all of that that we can use to predict weather, and our communications, radios, you know, electronic devices, handheld or portable laptops and that kind of stuff, has really pushed us out there. The other thing that we've done throughout the fire services is this discussion of risk management and having those hard decisions about risk versus gain when we are committing our assets into the operations, the daily operations. A lot of thought and a lot of decision making is based around risk management. The bottom line, though, is that firefighting is still a hazardous occupation, and fire managers unfortunately have to put young men and women in harm's way every day when we go to fight fire. And we just need to ensure that those values that we're trying to protect are worth the risk we're taking. You know, and I can speak from personal experience about having to put people in harm's way, and you worry about it all day long. It's like, you know, your teenagers learning to drive for the first time, and when they take the family car off on an outing, you know, that first evening, you know, not many parents sleep well that night till their kids come home. So it's kind of that feeling, and that's kind of how I relate it to those outside the fire service that have experienced that.
Do different agencies have different safety guidelines for firefighting, like Forest Service versus rural firefighting agencies versus state natural resources?
Most everybody uses the same processes, same procedures. Their equipment may look a little different. Some areas may have additional stricter requirements, but the National Wildfire Coordinating Group, or NWCG, has a very active risk management and safety group and is very active in, like, personal protective equipment, what we call PPE, the clothing, the helmets, the goggles, gloves, you know, and the equipment that people use. And most everybody involved in the wildland fire community follows those NWCG recommendations and guidelines. The National Fire Protection Association, or NFPA, also has some standards they have put out. And most firefighting agencies across the United States follow some of those standards or the NWCG recommendations and come equipped the same way.
How do the men and women, the ground pounders out there, how do they deal maintaining their protection and their safety while they're dealing with the heat and snags and bees and everything else that's going around them, aren't they inevitably going to get inattentive and a little sloppy in their decision-making? Or are there people who are paid to focus for them?
On a small incident at the module or the crew level, there's a captain, a module leader with a helitac crew. There's a superintendent with hotshot crews. All of our assets have leadership, and all of those leaders have that responsibility for the people that work for them. Now, they could and should assign somebody to provide that overwatch, you know, that lookout to help everybody. And most crew culture of the firefighter is to look out for each other. You know, hey, look at that snag over there, or, you know, we're going into some steep rocky ground, so spread your distance out a little bit farther. If somebody kicks a rock loose, you'll hear from way up on the hill, somebody will holler, "Rock!" You know, and everybody starts looking and looks for protection and a way to get out of the way. So there's good inter-crew communications. On a larger, more organized incident, we have division group supervisors that have a piece of the fire line, and they have that responsibility to help look out for the safety. We post lookouts. We are diligent about talking to our people about that every day. We require them to have what we call, you know, the tailboard safety meeting before they head off on their assignment and ask what risk might we face today and how are we going to try to mitigate those. And if we can't mitigate them, what are our options to work around that piece? You know, you get into a snag patch. What are our options here? Can we drop the snags? Can we move around that snag patch? So the crews are taught that. That's not to say that at points in time people get tired and things lapse, but we try to be diligent about safety and talking to each other about those things.
Do you think we place too much emphasis on structure protection these days? In other words, are we risking human life too much to protect homes in that interface, as they say?
You know, that's really a tough discussion. My background comes out of California where, you know, we have a lot of wildland urban interface and intermix, and we've struggled with that question for a number of years. It is a high value to be protected, and what we do is we ask those people that live in the wildland urban interface and those people that are thinking about moving out there, you know, in those communities that are there. My comment has always been, as a fire manager and as a, you know, retired fire chief from a local fire department, help us help you. Work on that defensible space. Give us that space to operate in. People can go to different websites, the FireWise community websites. They can stop by their local fire station, any federal wildland fire agency station, and ask, what can I do to help protect my property? Or get with their community leaders and say, what are we doing to protect our community? So, again, help us help you.
So give you guys a reason to say your neighborhood, your property, it moves up that triage list, basically.
Yeah, and it really does. I feel more comfortable as a fire manager committing assets to an area where they've done their defensible space, where they've had a community cleanup, where they have a green belt around their community. We don't have to put as many assets in there, and we can then put those assets to controlling the fire, which in many cases is the easiest way to protect those values that are being threatened, is to control the fire.
In the wake of Sunday's tragedy, do you think firefighters, managers will alter their operations, swing the pendulum to the other side, maybe play it too safe?
You know, that's a hard one to say. From just my personal point of view, it really makes you stop and reflect about what it is we're doing. And maybe there will be some more discussion at our planning meetings about those risk management principles that we instill in our people. All the firefighters in the field carry a pocket guide we call the IRPG that gives some principles as to risk management. Maybe more and more people will be pulling those out and thinking about that. Because all risk is personal, it will give people a chance to pause and reflect and think about what it is they're doing. And, you know, leaders throughout the fire service, at the local module level, the crew level, the engine level, clearing up to the top fire managers, are discussing this and thinking about it, and are going to have to make a diligent, honest effort in their own mind. How is this going to change how they do business?
Last question for you, Steve, and that is, in the past several years, it seems we're dealing with bigger, more out-of-control, badder fires, and lots of people are saying this is going to be the new norm. If that's the case, Do you think we're going to have to rewrite the safety rules and regs?
You know, I don't know about having to rewrite the entire regulations, but one of the things we do is we do after actions and we look at lessons learned. And, you know, having been an incident commander for a number of years, I know that, you know, my team and other teams, and when the National Incident Commanders get together and have discussions, we utilize those lessons learned to talk about how we're going to do business different. And, you know, it is, you know, just like any other business, we have to ask ourselves what's changed in our business environment in the last 5 years, 10 years, and what are we doing to change our business model to match those changes in the business environment. And that's what we need to continually look at to stay current, to stay safe, and to provide that service to our customers, whether that be the people that recreate on public lands. As stewards of the public lands, we have a responsibility, and that's part of our business. But, you know, how are we going to change our business model to match those changes in the business environment?
Never thought of it as a business model.
From my perspective, that's the way we need to approach things from a business perspective, because it makes good sense, because it involves fiscal issues, assets, personnel, those kinds of things. And people talk about a profit margin, and our profit margin is staying within the budget constraints because we are spending taxpayer dollars through the United States taxpayers, so we have a huge responsibility.
Yeah, that's a whole other discussion. Hey, I've been speaking with Steve Gage, Forest Service Assistant Fire Operations Director. I want to thank you for your very valuable time, and to you and all the men and women you work with. Please stay safe out there this summer, and thanks a ton in advance.
Thank you, sir, and have a good day.
Yesterday, we told you that Capitol reporter Dan Boyce would have the second of his two-part story on the Rainbow Family Gathering. Due to today's lockdown at the state capitol, where Dan's office is located, we're not able to bring that story to you as promised. We'll have that for you tomorrow on Montana Evening Edition, and we'll post it at mtbr.org. We apologize for the last-minute change of plan.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight will be mostly clear with lows in the 50s. For tomorrow and Independence Day, it will be mostly sunny with a slight chance of thunderstorms. Highs will be in the 80s to lower 90s. For central Montana, tonight it will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be between 50 to 60 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers throughout the day and a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will be between 80 to 90 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be partly cloudy with isolated showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 50s. Tomorrow, expect increasing clouds with a chance of rain showers throughout the day and a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will be in the upper 80s. Currently in our listening area, Helena is 93 degrees with partly cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's sunny with 90 degrees. Butte has 87 under fair skies. Great Falls is sunny with 97 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under sunny skies is 91 degrees. It's 87 and partly cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's sunny and 93 degrees. Libby has 85 with sunny conditions. And in Polson, skies are sunny and it's 91 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Mary Sheehy Moe.
In his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, James Loewen levels a scathing criticism at the subject of American history, as it was taught back when most of us were in high school. Christopher Columbus was not the first explorer to discover America, and his treatment of the New World's indigenous people is pretty hard to condone. The Pilgrims were not benefactors to the Indian tribes in Massachusetts. The reverse was the case. Manifest Destiny, slavery, war, all were sugar-coated beyond recognition and peopled by a monolithic parade of white male heroes. As we approach our nation's most treasured holiday, Independence Day, we trot out that old parade. We picture Washington, Jefferson, Adams, Franklin, the Founding Fathers. We don't picture the women who did so much to inspire, support, and fight for the independence of the United States of America. It's quite a story. We've all heard of Thomas Paine, whose pamphlet, Common Sense, fueled American resistance to the tyranny of Great Britain. but we haven't heard of Mercy Otis Warren, whose satirical plays and impassioned poems had the same effect in pre-revolutionary Boston. We haven't heard of Esther Reed, whose essay imploring American women to support the cause fueled a hugely successful funding drive in Pennsylvania that spread to other states when the resources and morale of the Revolutionary Army were at a dangerous low. We've all heard of Paul Revere, but other Midnight Riders aren't as famous. Emily Geiger was captured by the British while carrying a message from one American general to the other. She swallowed the note rather than relinquish it to the enemy. 16-year-old Sybil Luddington rode 40 miles to alert the Danbury militia of an impending attack. Another 16-year-old, Dicey Langston, forded a river that rose to her neck to bring news of the enemy to her brother's camp. Women were accomplices in the war effort. Lydia Dara observed the movements of British troops, recorded them in code, and hid them behind her son's coat buttons. Mrs. Robert Murray plied British officers with food and wine to keep them in her home long enough for heavily outnumbered American troops to pass by unnoticed. Catherine Schuyler rode miles to set fire to her own fields lest the British reap the wheat that flourished there. Margaret Corbin joined her husband in the fray at Fort Washington. When he was killed, she took over the artillery and sustained wounds that left her an amputee. Deborah Sampson disguised herself as a man and joined the troops. She was injured twice, but continued to volunteer for hazardous duty for 3 years. Martha Washington left her home and children behind to winter with George and the troops year after year. Her kindness and industry inspired men and women alike in the camps. Abigail Adams tended her husband's farm, business, family, and political career for years while he worked in Europe to establish allies and ultimately negotiate a peace agreement. While Benjamin Franklin was in London for a dozen years, his wife Deborah managed all his properties, and after her death, daughter Sally did the same when Franklin went to France for another decade. But heroism and sacrifice weren't confined to those whose names are now part of the historical record. With their homes commandeered or their towns besieged by enemy troops, countless women scavenged as they could, with their kids and elderly in tow. Many women took in the families of relatives and friends. Most participated in the economic sanctions that left them without basic necessities. And all, regardless of station in life, continued to be vulnerable to the life-threatening health issues of the day: smallpox, dysentery, childbirth. Martha Jefferson lost 3 children in their first year of life. She died giving birth to another. While John Adams was away with the Continental Congress, Abigail lost her mother to dysentery and delivered a stillborn child. And Esther Reed, she who wrote the remarkable fundraising essay, lost a 2-year-old to smallpox the day after she delivered her 5th child. Her 6th child, George Washington Reed, was born a month before her famous essay hit the press. Although she started a successful movement, Esther herself didn't live to deliver the bounty to the troops. She died 3 months after the essay was printed, a victim of dysentery. She was only 33 years old. Small wonder that the losing general in the Revolutionary War, Cornwallis, uttered in despair, "We may destroy all the men in America, and we shall still have all we can do to defeat the women." As we celebrate the courage of our founding fathers tomorrow, let's honor Abigail Adams's famous request, too, and remember the ladies. This is Mary Sheehy Moe, retired, but still advocating for free quality public education in Montana.
Mary Sheehy Moe is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.